Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. On this week's episode, Matt Moore, the Times media correspondent on the trouble at Radio 2. Fiona Hamilton, the Times crime editor, on crime figures and what Sajid Javid can do about them. But first, the Times chief political correspondent, Lucy Fisher, on Theresa May's trouble with Northern Ireland.
The landslide vote in favour of amending abortion law in Ireland has prompted calls for change in Northern Ireland, with Tory ministers and backbenchers backing calls for Westminster to intervene in the province. Theresa May is on a collision course with the DUP, the party propping up her fragile government.
So this is interesting. When Theresa May, I don't like to laugh, but when she lost a majority in June last year and then had to rely on the support of 10 DUP MPs, it was thought at the time that the sort of social reform flashpoint would be on gay marriage. And there was a lot of reassurance to Ruth Davies and people like that that there was going to be no backpedalling and actually was going to pursue that in Northern Ireland. And actually, because of what's happened in Ireland, completely independently of what's been happening in the UK, the referendum voted overwhelmingly for reform in Ireland. This is suddenly, in Theresa May's already quite full in-tray, created a huge nightmare.
Yes, a huge nightmare. I think it's sort of it's clear from the blanket calls across the Commons from the front benches, and Milton, the skills minister, was on the airwaves at the weekend saying that she believed that there was a significant majority in the Commons to change the law in Northern Ireland, and pointing out that, of course, traditionally votes on abortion, like euthanasia and other matters of conscience, have traditionally been free votes, piling pressure on Theresa May. Of course, Labour's frontbench position is to back for women in Northern Ireland to have the same rights as everywhere else in the UK. And to my mind, I can't really see how the DUP have a leg to stand on. They're kind of arguing that this is a devolved matter of healthcare and that Westminster shouldn't intervene. But in actual fact, at the moment, you've got three women a day from Northern Ireland travelling to the mainland and procuring terminations on the NHS in England, Wales and Scotland that are paid for by taxpayers in those countries. So I think that there is a grey area here and something I feel really strongly about changing.
And the interesting thing is that the DUP's position is, well, it's devolved, which is, healthcare is devolved, but human rights aren't. Mm-hmm. And so it depends on whether you're treating it as a health issue or a human rights issue. The other thing is...
And worth pointing out that the United Nations has said that the current law is transgressing the human rights of women in Northern Ireland.
And the other problem is basically nothing is devolved at the moment because the Stormont Assembly has been suspended for more than a year. So there's nothing happening in Northern Ireland. And it all really just comes down to the politics. This is Theresa May having to shore up her political position in Westminster. She can't afford to upset the DUP, 10 of them, but the 10 most important people in the Commons in some sense.
Yeah.
Can she hold that position?
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, it must be agonising for her. I feel that feminism, sort of standing up for women's rights, is a sort of core part of her legacy, which she'll be looking to ever more closely, with talk of a kind of a leadership contest as soon as sort of we're out of the EU, possibly even before. It's difficult to see. I was struck by the fact that she waited until midday after the results of the Irish referendum had been announced to sort of congratulate and kind of comment on the results there. And, you know, she's sort of something that she wants her government, her administration to be known for. You know, she really backed Amber Rudd trying to kind of change the law on domestic violence. There's a consultation on that at the moment. But equally, if the DUP go against her, that literally is the collapse of her government.
And I thought it was telling that the Labour attack line, the one that Shami Chakrabarti was using at the weekend, describing the Prime Minister as a self-identifying feminist, was pretty devastating.
Pretty devastating, and also a sort of a dig at the Tories' ambivalence about self-ID when it comes to trans rights. I think Labour have really backed Theresa May into a corner.
What do you make of this, Fiona?
Well, it's just a dreadful dilemma for Theresa May, because I imagine, I mean, personally, a no-brainer on the law and how it should be changed. That's personally for me, but I imagine, as Lucy says, that's something she probably feels quite strongly about. But to be backed into a corner like this, where really the loss of DUP support, a complete disaster. I can't really see how this one plays out. And I see it as an interesting, if you take a broader view just of how this government is sort of going on at the moment. Last week, she got rid of the Leveson 2 dilemma, which was a huge problem for her. And now another, even bigger, much more emotional problem crops up. It's going to be all over the papers, dreadful stories of women who have had to travel or have perhaps died because they haven't been allowed those rights. And I'm not quite sure where it ends for them.
And the problem is, if you speak to any Tory whips, they spend... There's only so many times they can twist someone's arms and pull off their fingernails. If they've got no fingernails left, trying to persuade them to, like, you know, they haven't even got to Brexit, the EU withdrawal bill, to try and persuade, you know, they've got to try and get that through Parliament. Even having to deal with the political fallout of another vote on this is a problem. What about you, Matt? What do you make of it?
What I'd be very interested in is there any polling around what people in Northern Ireland would vote for an abortion if there was a referendum? Because if for some reason Theresa May imposed a referendum or DUP agreed to have one, they would presumably then campaign against any major change to the law. And Northern Ireland doesn't seem to have gone through the social liberalisation process that the South has done with gay marriage and gay rights over the last 4 or 5 years. Would Northern Ireland be buck the sort of liberal trend and vote to keep its own abortion laws? And what would that do?
It's a really good question. There was a poll that Amnesty International carried out last year that showed, I think it was about 3/4 in support for changing the law, okay. At least in the case of incest and rape,
okay.
I think. I mean, obviously campaigners have sort of argued that was about the sample size. I think it was about 1,000 people. I think they argue it wasn't the right kind of conditions for a kind of trustworthy poll. But it's a really good question whether it's kind of less liberal than it's sort of sister republic. But
yeah, and it, well, maybe the process of going through a campaign, because it seemed from the outside that Southern Ireland and particularly Southern Irish women, it's been hugely energising and mobilising this issue around sort of broader liberal causes, whether we could see something beneficial for Belfast Northern Ireland politics as well if there was this referendum and people were allowed to kind of speak out about these taboos, maybe shrink away from religious and sectarian politics.
You're a brave man coming into this studio and advocating another referendum. Generally, we have a very strong line against any voting on anything in particular. But interestingly, there's been a bit of a split, it seems, even amongst Labour. You've got some people calling for a referendum in Northern Ireland, and other people saying that you don't need to have a referendum because...
You could just change the law.
You could just change the law. Yeah. And actually, there was one in Ireland because constitutionally they needed to, literally amending the constitution. And there are just the conditions that the Westminster Parliament, with its elected MPs, can just vote on this as they do on other matters.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So there is that split. Some people want a referendum. They're only advisory in Northern Ireland, so it wouldn't be binding if they did hold one. And other people like Stella Creasy, the Labour MP, who is planning to table an amendment to the domestic violence bill when it comes before the Commons. As I say, there's a consultation at the moment that ends at the end of this month. So legislation could yet be some way off and thrown into the long grass if this, you know, if this is going to continue to be a problem for Theresa May. But the likes of Stella Creasy and sort of women's rights campaigners think that this is too urgent an issue and that Westminster should kind of go ahead and change the law without a referendum. While I feel really strongly about it, I'm slightly ambivalent myself, because I think what would be the unintended consequences to the constitutional arrangement and the Sewell principle of not intervening with major kind of constitutional and ethical changes in the province. But it is an urgent issue, and perhaps that should be the way they go forward.
It does put the spotlight back on what's going on in Northern Ireland with the power sharing and the collapse of government and how long that is going to take to get things back there. I was there a couple of weeks ago and people were complaining, nothing's happening there, nothing's moving. They're in a massive limbo at the most important time in recent history with Brexit negotiations.
And just before we move on, I just want to ask you, Philip, about, because this is what this again highlights, is that although we are part of the United Kingdom, there are different laws in all bits of it. When you're doing your job, how much of it do you have to spend trying to work out the different legal system in Scotland and England and Wales and Northern Ireland?
Well, the Scottish legal system is utterly confounding. I hope they don't. I think a lot
carefully
of Scots might agree. Although they may say the same about the system down here. So it's very different. And actually, in terms of doing my job, whilst the security aspect of my job, occasionally I delve into Northern Ireland, actually it's very separate. And until recently, I don't think we have that great interest in what's going on in Northern Ireland. I'm not talking about newspapers necessarily, but the population as a whole here. The last time I went to Northern Ireland for work was 7 years ago, when there was a police officer very terribly attacked in a car bomb and killed, and that was in Omagh, so that was obviously resonated very, very strongly. And it was interesting being over there because there were all sorts of security alerts. In the week that I was there, there were about seven, I think, and they would never ordinarily make the news here. So I would have to plead a little bit of ignorance on that.
All journalists have suddenly, particularly political journalists, have suddenly become very detailed experts in the board of arrangements and constitutional niceties of Stormont, which doesn't exist. But it will be interesting to see how this pans out. But let's move on for now. And this is Fiona Hamilton.
After years of hostilities following Plebgate, swingeing cuts and unpopular reform, are the Tory police relationships beginning to thaw? And what was behind new Home Secretary Sajid Javid's charm offensive at the Police Federation conference last week?
Now, this was fascinating. It was a good game of spot the difference to be had between the speech that Theresa May used to give to the Police Federation, telling them stop crying wolf and just get on with it, stop moaning. And he really ladled it on, Sajid Javid, in his debut outing.
He really did. I mean, I've had the enormous pleasure of attending the Police Federation conference for several years.
It's always by the sea, isn't it? That's
it's
something.
Not anymore. It used to be in Bournemouth.
Was it not in Bournemouth anymore? It,
very pleasant. It's now in Birmingham, which I have to say is a great city. Lots of lovely places to go and eat. And we all had a very good time. But a really, really big difference. It's been very frosty over the last few years. Of course, Theresa May famously gave her speech to them where she said, you're crying wolf over police cuts. And that did not go down very well at all. And in subsequent years, it perhaps got a little bit better towards the end of her time as Home Secretary, but there hasn't been warm support for the Tories, quite the opposite. Amber Rudd, it was interesting, even as recently in November. I mean, we've all been talking about violent crime increasing for the past, since New Year's Eve, really, has been a major issue for the papers. But actually, it's been increasing for well over a year. And she went to a conference of police chiefs in November and told them, first of all, that crime was not increasing, which raised some eyebrows because it was an interesting interpretation of the statistics.
I think it was very much a Ruddian interpretation of the facts, which we came to see later on and led to a doubtful.
Quite. But also told them to stop complaining. The public didn't want to hear their complaining, and the public just wanted to see them cut crime and fight crime. Now, I think Sajid maybe has seen that actually the public are listening to the police complaining and that the public are not happy. And I think the Tories are very concerned about the rise, particularly in violent crime, but crime overall in certain areas. And they're meant to be the party that is strong on law and order, and it's not really looking like that. And they need the support of the police back, and they've really lost it at you know, the rank and file particularly. But all the way through.
Is there ever a time when the Police Federation liked the government of the day? Because I mean, they're essentially like a trade union, and they all, trade unions always want more money and
of course
better, you know, more staff and all of that.
Of course, and I think they started to talk about cuts about 6 or 7 years ago, and there was probably not the case that there is today, but they do have that case now. I mean, at the conference I heard leaders talking about a deficit of 5,000 detectives, the soaring crime rates in certain areas, and a really real difficult way, very difficult for them to work out how to tackle that because they've lost more than 20,000 police officers. So those cuts really, the cuts have consequences, has been the Fed's slogan for many years now, and they are making that point quite strongly.
It's now starting to hammer home. Lucy, I was struck in Red Box this week. We had a piece actually about anything to do with Brexit.
Mm.
Imagine there was no Brexit. And interestingly, looking at the polling from public attitudes about challenges the country faced immediately before the referendum and now, crime is one of the ones that's gone up a lot.
Yeah, it was only crime and
crime,
health.
Crime and health had really gone up. Obviously, Brexit has appeared as a sort of massive issue above that. But this is a problem for the Tories, isn't it? If they're even losing ground on the thing that they're the party of law and order.
Yeah, it struck me actually. It's one of those things I've heard about from a lot of MPs. They talk, when you sort of chat to them in the corridors of Westminster, what are you hearing in your surgeries? What's troubling you casework-wise? There's been a real lag with sort of the national conversation catching up with what lots of MPs have been aware of locally, both in the shires, kind of rural areas. I think we tend to think of crime only as sort of an urban problem, but it seems really across the board people have been concerned about this for a couple of years. And of course, it really came to hurt Theresa May in the snap election last year, where with the kind of the terror attacks that happened, the spate of terrible attacks we had before the poll, questions started to be asked about, police cuts, both in relation to kind of national security, but I think also increasingly crime. I just wonder, Fiona, what you think. It's sort of, Matt and I are constantly listening to Police Minister Nick Hurd on the airwaves and his colleagues trying to argue that 20,000, fall of 20,000 police officers since 2010 doesn't have an effect, and actually all the studies show that doesn't matter or doesn't affect kind of crime rates. Surely that's nonsense.
I think also the one of the issues is that crime is increasingly complex for a variety of different issues, and you need it's not just about numbers. You need people who actually know what they're doing. They're well trained.
a lot of them do.
But you just add another 20,000. That won't necessarily solve the problems that we're facing here. You have to take a quite sophisticated view if you're a senior police leader these days, because you're coming up against, for example, the terrorists, who are much harder to detect these days because of technology and encrypted applications and all those sorts of issues, and the globalisation of terrorism. You're dealing with much, much more vulnerable people, child sex grooming, all those sorts of issues, infinitely more complicated to tackle than traditional crime, which has been falling, although it's starting to increase again, but your traditional car break and enters, all that sort of stuff. So I think that there are really fundamental problems. The other thing I think that's quite interesting in terms of the impact it will have on the Tories and their voter base is that the police are having to make very difficult decisions about what they tackle, and quite naturally they have to focus on online sex abuse, grooming scandals, those really complex crimes. But those only affect a relatively small proportion of the population. Most people, most of us who are affected by crime, will be affected by a burglary or somebody breaking into a shed or vandalism. And if those people start to feel that they don't get any impact or any, because the police can't turn up to some of those crimes, I think that is going to pose a really difficult political problem.
Matt, one of the things that really shocked me, both during the election campaign last year and again this year when there was the spike in violent crime in London, is that the Labour Party, not always the most politically adept operators, actually managed to wrong-foot the Tories on law and order. And if you're being outfoxed on law and order by Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott, well, something's gone wrong.
I wonder whether that's partly a reflection of the very decent PR job that elements of the police have done in recent years. And Fiona will know more about this than me, but I remember watching police-fed conferences many years ago, the Theresa May one you mentioned, and they were male, pale and stale. They seemed like a kind of a very much an interest group that needed reform, and their opinions could be dismissed. And I think sections of the police have done quite well recently in opening themselves up to the challenges they face. Sorry to put a media spin on it, but last night I watched a Channel 4 documentary, 24 Hours in Police Custody, where the head of Bedfordshire Police had given great access to a Channel 4 crew to film a very complex drugs investigation. Extraordinary footage, and it really put into kind of very public terms the challenges the police face, how good they can be at getting to grips with them, but the fact that they do need more resources and crime is getting more complex. And I think that's that sort of openness and candor like that that some forces have shown have helped change the conversation and made people, the average member of the public, a bit more sympathetic to police claims than they were 5 years ago.
Yeah, I don't think there's many forces who haven't done an in-force documentary. Although I wish they would allow us such amazing access to what people are doing, but perhaps I'm a little bit bitter.
But we've seen a similar thing in the NHS, the BBC's Fly on the Wall documentary.
Yeah, the Doctor series there.
The Doctor series and Ambulance all of those give those sort of... And they're obviously going to be more dramatic because they're the things that end up on TV, but that people feel like they're getting the true story versus whatever spin it is that politicians are giving them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think broadcast media has done, because they get better access than myself and other print colleagues, it's possibly been broadcast media documentaries that have captured the extent to which austerity is having a sort of real world effect and mobilised this movement we are seeing where people are saying enough is enough and we actually need to fund off our public services better. It's a sort of a testament to the power of television.
And just very quickly, Finn, what impact do you think Sajid Javid will have at the Home Office, given, I mean, Amber Rudd seemed constrained from day one by the fact that she was doing the boss's old job and never really got out from underneath the weight of that. He's clearly trying to say from the get-go that he is different. Do you think that's real?
Yeah. I mean, he's clearly sort of set down his stall in that regard. And I mean, somebody at the Fed conference said to me, well, it can only get worse from here. And really what he's got to do if he wants to continue in the same way is come up with the money, and that might be quite difficult. I mean, Cressida Dick asked for a couple of £100 million for terrorism and was rejected. If they're saying no to extra funding, counter-terrorism budget is actually, it's ring-fenced and they do quite well. But if they're saying no to something that really does resonate at the highest levels of government, I think he will have an uphill task.
The one good thing from the Police Federation speech, we've now got a new relative, because previously he was always the son of a bus driver.
Yes.
And now he's the brother of a police officer. Which half the speech was about
his
brother.
Who's just passed the strategic command course and is going up the ranks, so
I bet
congratulations to him.
Very good. In a sec, we'll be talking about Trouble at Radio 2. We'll be back after this short break.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Times Red Box podcast with me, Matt Jolly. Joined in the studio by Lucy Fisher, Fiona Hamilton, and this is Matthew Moore.
Radio 2 listeners are up in arms about changes to the station's drive time show, which have seen Joe Wiley paired with the slot's long-standing host, Simon Mayo. Are they just griping about change, or is this a BBC blunder?
Now, this change slightly annoyed me, because I when I wrote a column about the House of Lords, I described it as being as white, pale and middle-aged as the Radio 2 schedule.
They've stolen your metaphor.
Yeah, and now they've gone, right, get Joe Wiley in there. So this is the BBC trying to show that it's...
Yeah, the context for all this, the change was announced in January, shortly after weeks and weeks of headlines about BBC equality sparked by the Carrie Gracie resignation. So it was part of the corporation trying to get on the front foot and saying we are addressing a long-standing issue, which is just how male the weekday daytime schedule is on Radio 2 and has been for 25 years. From breakfast to drive time, it's all been men. So it was a change along these lines was long overdue. They needed to try and diversify the daytime lineup. It's Britain's most listened to radio station. So they decided to take the very popular drive time show presented by Simon Mayo, which had 6 million listeners and did the same sort of features day after day that people were very familiar with and enjoyed on their commute home. And they took another very popular presenter, Joe Wiley, who did the evening show, and moved her into the drive time show, which they now share. It's been 2 weeks since that change came into force, and certainly the listener reaction has been overwhelmingly negative. There is a sense that there is no dynamic between them. The chemistry is very poor. They seem to be completing each other's sentences, and these are small gripes, but they're things that are very noticeable to listeners who've been with the show for years and see the presenter and his team of co-presenters as part of their friendship group. Essentially, you spend 2 hours a day listening to this show more than you spend with your friends or your family. So there has been a major backlash. There's been two petitions set up on websites. I appreciate who petitions has, mean little these
who
days.
Who has time to go around setting up petitions about what's on? Change the channel.
I think people have a sense of ownership over their radio station in the way they don't over their TV station. Mm. I think if they changed BBC Breakfast lineup, it wouldn't have got this backlash. There've been two petitions. There've been sort of the controller of BBC Radio has sort of done interviews where he's referred to how he acknowledges the sort of unhappiness, but asked people to give the chance to bed the show down. Some people say that the last week the show got a bit better, the dynamic seems to be improving. But I think it's just a reflection of how difficult it is for the BBC to address these legacy equality issues without alienating a listenership that doesn't like change, that wants consistency, that wants familiarity. And they may not have handled it in the best way, but it's a reflection of them trying to update their schedules in a way to appeal to a broader range of listeners.
Is the risk that, having done it ham-fistedly, they don't attempt to address it across the board in other parts of the BBC?
I guess you could say that if they just crowbar a woman onto a previously a man show, that's a way of ticking that box. Other changes have been made at the station that have been promoting other female DJs. It's part of a process, and the context to it is almost age rather than gender, because the BBC, the controller of BBC Music, has said that the Radio 2 is doing hugely well with 55 pluses, but sort of 35 to 55, it's been flatlining, and they need to get people who are in that age bracket. And Joe Wiley appeals more to them as a former Radio 1, recent former Radio 1 DJ, than Simon Mayo, who is slightly older and has a slightly older demographic.
And the main way they seem to be doing it is by playing unlistenable noise on Radio 1. I often discover. Lucy, what do you make of this? Are you a Radio 2 listener?
I like a bit of Radio 2. It makes me laugh, actually. My father bought for me Jeremy Vine's autobiography as a Christmas gift a while ago. And I was laughing about listening to what you were saying, because he was talking about when he first arrived with his show, how the sort of the great conservatism, sporty conservatism of the British public kind of completely rejected him to begin with, and he needed a lot of time to kind of bed in. And now, to my mind, he is the sort of the voice of the station. So maybe it's just sort of people, I don't know, don't like change generally. But I guess, I don't know, I do think that there is a problem with the age thing. And now that radio has become democratized with, you know, podcasts, and I would imagine that most people my age in their 20s or 30s are more likely to kind of get a podcast on their sort of smartphone rather than turn on a digital or analog radio. It is a problem for the BBC.
Yeah, and I think there's an argument they could be a little bit relaxed about that. They've got huge audiences of young people for their podcast. Do they need the 5 p.m. Radio 2 slot to have a bunch of 30-year-olds listening? Why not? If 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds enjoy it, why not go after them? So yeah, I think there's certainly a group of old Radio 2 listeners who feel like their ears aren't wanted, and younger ears are required.
Presumably they're panicking a little bit in a way, because they're seeing an exodus of people to Spotify as well as podcasts. Mm-hmm. But of course, I listen to Radio 4, but I didn't, you know, if I want easy listening and what I enjoy, I always turn to Spotify. And they've got the same problem on the telly, haven't they, with Netflix? So
yeah, absolutely. This is the sort of the broader epochal challenge facing the BBC, is how do you make yourself relevant when subscription services are stealing your audiences, and there doesn't seem to be anything that those services can't do that you can do solely. So perhaps local news and things like that Netflix isn't offering, but there is
it would be good though if they did soon,
yeah. Watch that.
Netflix does local news would be excellent. Be really dramatic.
Well, they'd have the resources to do it if they wish to, but yeah, the BBC needs to create a USP for itself in 8 years' time. What are they doing that none of these global international subscription services are currently doing? And that's the headache for Tony Hall at the moment.
Can I ask you about, this is not so much radio, but as you've kind of mentioned the subscription services, what this strikes me is the BBC does have a USP in creating both kind of format shows like Strictly Come Dancing, mm-hmm. and some brilliant kind of dramas, sort of especially the period dramas and sort of Dickens style, you know, 3, 5, 10 parters. And there was a great article by Jeremy Paxman in the FT the other weekend about why the BBC is so sort of passive in its negotiations with it kind of pays studios to kind of develop these fantastic shows or dramas, mm-hmm. and then, you know, after, you know, 28 days have elapsed on your iPlayer, it's then sold off to Netflix, and you have to, you know, you're a taxpayer, you've paid for your license fee, then you have to pay again to watch it.
Yeah, and that is something that the BBC is addressing there now. They own a significant studio arms now, and they are certainly, conversations are ongoing between BBC, ITV, Channel 4 about how they can maybe pool resources or come together to combat Netflix and Amazon, maybe a single service that offered some subscription content and focused on British made shows, dramas and sort of shiny floor shows, and it's definitely something they're looking at. But then that brings complexities to itself, because obviously the BBC has its own charter, ITV and Channel 4 are funded in very different ways. How do you allow these services to come together and try and take on the might of Netflix? It's not easily fixable.
And the speed of these things move, because we've gone from, the BBC is the dominant, you know, player in all of this, and now they're playing we're the underdog, we don't really know what to do. You know, the BBC is still massive.
Yeah, it's extraordinary how quickly the likes of Netflix have risen. There was a story about a year ago that Disney was thinking of buying them, and last weekend Netflix outgrew Disney for the first time in terms of market capitalisation. So, yeah, these things change very quickly.
And just going back to our original point and Joe Wiley's plight on a fortnight on Radio 2, Fiona and Lucy, as women in the room, is it just sort of patronise? Would you be any more inclined to listen to Simon Mayo because there was now a woman, you know, introducing 50% of the records?
I think anything that has that veneer of tokenism, if there is, and this is, I don't mean this against Joe Wiley at all, but I think that would probably turn me off. I wouldn't listen to something just because it now had a woman. But of course, the gender pay gap is absolutely disgraceful, and they do need to do things to sort it out. So it's a difficult one.
I agree with you. I wouldn't listen to something a specific show because specifically they had introduced a woman. But on the other hand, without quotas, without binding targets, things don't seem to change. You know, it's 2018, and why is there a major national radio station, taxpayer funded, that has entirely a male, you know, schedule, you know, for most of the day? So I don't know what the alternative is to solve the problem.
Well, I know what they should have done. They should have got rid of Ken Booth. That's what they should have done. They should have got rid of Ken Booth and just given Joe Wiley or somebody their own show. But I fear that's probably straying into the most dangerous territory we have in the last half an hour. That's all we've got time for this week. As ever, subscribe to my email, the Redbox morning email. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes on your Android device. But for now, from Lucy Fisher, Fiona Hamilton, Matt Moore and me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.